The following podcast is part of a certified educational activity titled A Joint Effort for Equitable Hemophilia A Care, Collaborative Solutions for Enhancing Outcomes in Diverse and Challenging Patient Populations. Access the entire activity and complete the post-test at peerview.com/GJM860. Downloadable slides and practice aids are also available.
Welcome. I'm Dr. Amy Shapiro from the Indiana Hemophilia and Thrombosis Center. I'm here with my colleague, Dr. Jean Bain, and we're presenting today a joint effort for equitable hemophilia A care. We'll start with the first module, which is the big picture, our current standards and unmet needs in hemophilia A. First, let's set the stage about the population we're discussing today. We're going to talk about the prevalence of mild, moderate, and severe hemophilia A, which is data collected from the Center for Disease Control through their national studies. They have two parts to these studies. One is the population profile, which is the light blue number. This includes all the patients cared for within HTCs. And what you can see here is that approximately 42% of the patients nationwide are severe, and a significant number are mild and moderate. The second part of the data through the CDC is what's called the registry study or community counts. That's an opt-in or opt-out. So not all of the patients in the population profile are represented in the registry or in community counts. Same thing. Approximately 52% of the patients in the registry are severe, meaning that treatment centers either tend to approach more severe patients or patients who are more severe tend to enter the registry. However, we still have a significant number of patients with mild and moderate disease represented within the registry, which collects far more detailed information than the population profile does. We can also look at the proportion of male and female persons with hemophilia A from this data. Males with hemophilia A represent a greater number of patients within the registry, again, showing that we tend to represent them more in the more detailed information we collect, whereas female patients are represented only 6% of the registry. We have far less female patients in the registry, and the questions we have to ask ourselves are they diagnosed as mild or moderate deficient patients, and are they approached for entry into the registry? In fact, for every male with hemophilia A, it's estimated there are approximately 1.5 female carriers, and approximately one-third of these carriers have a low level of their factor, either factor 8 or factor 9. We're specifically speaking about hemophilia A or factor 8 deficiency here. So there should be at least an equal number of individuals that are represented here. And as you can see, they're not. We've had substantial progress that's been achieved over the last 40 years in terms of the types of therapy that we've been able to utilize for treatment of our patients with bleeding disorders. These advancements have really accelerated over the last decade. And now we have non-factor therapies, we have a von Willebrand factor independent, truly extended half-life, factor 8 therapy, we have gene therapies that are licensed on the market for factor 8 and 9 deficiency. And so the question is, how do we utilize these new advanced therapies to approach the target population to improve their care? In the background, the standards for prophylaxis have evolved over time, as have the treatments we've actually utilized for care. In the beginning, when we first started prophylaxis, we thought that a target trough level of approximately 1% was adequate to achieve the goal we wanted in severe hemophilia A. This was based on the observation that individuals with moderate factor VIII deficiency experienced far less spontaneous bleeding episodes than their severe counterparts. Therefore, the 1% was targeted, and that's what we achieved, but we realized that patients still had breakthrough bleeding episodes. The current World Hemophilia guidelines now recommend targeting a trough level of approximately 3 to 5% or higher. And we're going to discuss this a bit later on in the presentation about what would represent an appropriate target or an achievable target going forward. This observation or recommendation from the World Hemophilia Foundation is based on the observation that 1 to 2% trough levels don't really eliminate bleeding episodes or prevent joint disease in the population that we're caring for. And this also recognizes that individuals who have moderate hemophilia A could benefit from prophylaxis, and we're going to present some information later that actually shows what the impact of moderate deficient hemophilia is in terms of bleeding episodes and joint disease. There's growing evidence that suggests that joint bleeding episodes really only approach zero when the baseline factor VIII levels are above 12%. And actually, there's some data we're going to show you later that represents even higher levels of that. This acknowledges that persons with mild hemophilia A, some of them could benefit from prophylaxis. So for example, there are individuals with levels above 5% that are below what we consider the threshold for approaching zero bleeding episodes that are still experiencing bleeding and suffering some of the more morbidity that's associated with that. So in summary, really, despite the advances that we've achieved, the real-world data suggests that more work needs to be done. We have oftentimes delayed and inadequate care due to a falling number of classical hematologists, especially in the adult world across the United States. It can be difficult for some of our adult patients with hemophilia to find someone who's quite knowledgeable about their disorder to provide the level of care that's required. We have lack of routine prophylaxis for persons with moderate or mild hemophilia. In other words, we've looked at our patients with severe disease. We've tried to institute adequate prophylaxis for them, but by doing that, we may be leaving our moderate and mild patients behind, and this includes females, and this results in a clinical burden expressed in bleeding frequency and subsequent joint disease. We have under-recognition, under-diagnosis, and non-treatment of females with hemophilia, including issues related to the female reproductive tract, specifically unique bleeding symptoms that this population experiences. And we have breakthrough bleeding episodes despite what we think is adequate prophylaxis and the presence of untreated or undertreated bleeds, even in patients with severe hemophilia A. So what are our expectations for improved outcomes when we look at the population? What we would like is an increased identification and engagement of persons with mild and moderate hemophilia A, including females. We'd like to really look at the need for prophylaxis in all patients who could benefit, and we would like to decrease their burden of care. And that burden of care is not just the burden of administering therapy, but it's also the burden of treating bleeding episodes and having your life interrupted or not achieving your specific personal goals for activity in your life. We'd like to increase protection against bleeding for people with hemophilia A, and we'd also like to enable individuals who live with this condition to live active lives, similar to that of unaffected individuals. I think we need to ask our patients, what is it you want to achieve? What goals are you not achieving due to the experience of your hemophilia? Or what kinds of activities are you afraid to participate in or avoid because of your hemophilia? So our goals for today are to heighten the awareness of ongoing inequities in hemophilia A care across all disease subtypes, to augment understanding of the evidence that supports established and emerging agents for prophylaxis in severe and non-severe hemophilia A, to enhance ability to develop personalized treatment plans for all persons with hemophilia A, regardless of their gender or disease severity, and equip care providers with the resources to address patient education, dosing, adherence, and safety considerations going forward with these therapies. I'd now like to turn it over to Dr. Jeanne Bain to discuss Module 2.
Thank you. And I will be discussing, I will start in Module 2 with discussing the current progress in severe in the treatment of severe hemophilia A and the different categories that are available for treatment. So currently, we can easily divide our treatment options into three groups. The first group where we're really replacing the missing protein. And here we have the standard half-life, the extended half-life, and the new or more enhanced extended half-life. And then there is the group where we can call it the non-replacement therapies, and that include the factor VIII mimetics, as well as rebalancing agents or inhibitors of naturally occurring anticoagulants. And then the last group is the group of gene therapy, where we're providing a functional gene or editing an abnormal gene in order to restore the endogenous protein expression of factor VIII or factor IX, and therefore leading to the potential for long-term treatment. There's one product that has been approved for the treatment of hemophilia B in 2022, and one product for the treatment of hemophilia A in 2023. And to start with the progress that has been actually done in the class of replacement factor VIII therapy with the new enhanced or true extended half-life factor VIII product that was approved in 2023. And I'm going to call it for the rest of this presentation EFA, just for the ease of efanesoctocog alpha. So it's they started actually by using a recombinant B-domain deleted factor VIII, and to which they added FC portion as well as X10 polypeptides to increase its half-life. And then they added a D-prime D3 fragment of von Willebrand, providing the stability that usually endogenous von Willebrand provides to factor VIII after infusion, but really making it now independent of our own endogenous or the patient's endogenous von Willebrand factor, and therefore overcoming the ceiling that the half-life of von Willebrand was imposing on the previous extended half-life products. This molecule, the efficacy of this molecule and the safety was actually evaluated in a phase 3 study or extend 1. As you can see here, the design of this study included two arms, group A and group B. This study actually enrolled adolescents and adults, so males with males and females aged above 12 years old. In group A, patients that were on previous prophylaxis continued in with once weekly prophylaxis EFA, 50 units per kilogram, and that included 133 patients. And in group B, there were patients that were on previous on-demand treatment. They were enrolled on demand with EFA 50 units per kilogram. And then after 26 weeks, they switched to EFA prophylaxis weekly. The primary endpoint that was captured in this study was the mean ABR. But secondary endpoints were also captured, including intrapatient comparison of the ABR during the prophylaxis in group A, as well as treatment of bleeding episodes, safety, pharmacokinetics, changes in physical health, pain, and joint health. As you can see here, the Extend 1 met its primary endpoint, supporting really the use of EFA in severe hemophilia A for prophylaxis. Indeed, the mean ABR was 0.71 in the prophylaxis arm or group A, and the median ABR or the most frequent number was zero. And patients with zero bleeding episodes were actually 86%. Another study looking at the efficacy and safety of EFA in kids or the younger than 12 years old is ongoing, and interim data has been presented at different meetings. This study, again, it did actually enroll patients into two arms, arm one for the younger patients, less than 6 years of age, and arm two for the patients aged between 6 and 12 years. And the regimen was once weekly EFA 50 units per kilogram prophylaxis, and they were followed for 52 weeks. The primary endpoint in this study was the inhibitor development, which is defined as inhibitor greater or equal to 0.6 Bethesda unit. But key secondary endpoints were also captured, including PK, ABR, or annualized bleeding rate, efficacy for bleed treatments and perioperative management, as well as safety. The Extend Kids met its endpoints with no development of inhibitors detected. Median ABR and overall ABR were actually 0 and 0.89, respectively. And a single dose of 50 units per kilogram was able to resolve the majority of bleeds, as well as the perioperative hemostasis was rated as excellent during major surgeries. And 88% of patients had zero spontaneous bleeds. As far as safety with EFA, there were, and that is actually from the two studies, but mainly from the Extend 1 study in the adolescents and adults, there were no reports of serious allergic reactions, anaphylaxis, or vascular thrombotic events. The most common adverse events that actually occurred in more than 5% of patients were headache, arthralgia, and back pain, as well as fall. And of note, 11 patients were positive for pre-existing anti-drug antibodies, but that did not really affect their PK when they were compared to the antibody-negative population. So far, these studies have proved the efficacy and safety of EFA in patients with hemophilia. If we switch gears now and we talk about the factor VIII mimetics, there is one approved factor VIII mimetic that has been approved for several years now, and several other in development. How do factor VIII mimetics really compare to factor VIII? If we think about like factor VIII being this cofactor that leads to thrombin generation by bringing together the activated factor IX and factor X, so bringing closer proximity activated factor IX so that now it can activate 10 and generate thrombin. In patients with deficiency in factor VIII, whether they have or they don't have inhibitors, as we're going to see later, factor VIII mimetic was developed to really replace the role of the missing factor VIII. And this is a bispecific antibody that has two epitopes. One binds to the activated factor IX, and one binds to factor X, bringing them again in close proximity. So now the activated factor IX can activate factor X. It does differentiate itself a little bit from factor VIII, and the main really difference that you need to keep in mind for in general, and especially here in this presentation, is the fact that emicizumab has a lower affinity for its substrates and enzymes compared to factor VIII. And what is driving really the thrombin generation now is more the amount of activated factor IX available. But if we look at the efficacy and how this molecule translates in clinical practice, the efficacy of emicizumab in treating, and especially in prophylaxis in patients with hemophilia, was assessed in several studies. In this slide, you can see the four studies that actually evaluated the efficacy of and safety of emicizumab prophylaxis in patients with severe hemophilia at different ages. HAVEN 1 for the adults and adolescents with factor VIII inhibitors. HAVEN 2 was actually focusing on the pediatric population with factor VIII inhibitors. HAVEN 3 looked at the adolescents and adults without factor VIII inhibitors. And HAVEN 4 looked also at the adults and adolescents with or without factor VIII inhibitors. But they looked here at the Q4 week dosing in addition to the Q1 week, Q2 weeks that were extensively studied in the previous studies. As you can see here, the impact of emicizumab prophylaxis in patients with hemophilia A as published in this article in Blood in 2021. After following actually the patients that switched to emicizumab prophylaxis with nearly 3 years follow-up, there was a clear lower bleed rates that were maintained with emicizumab prophylaxis. And after week 24, you can see that 97% at least of these patients had less than three bleeds in each treatment interval. So emicizumab also was well tolerated over this long-term follow-up. HAVEN 7 study came to actually really focus on the efficacy and safety of emicizumab in infants. As we're going to discuss later, emicizumab really did answer an unmet need in this patient population. And as you can see here, HAVEN 7 did prove the efficacy across bleeding endpoints in infants with hemophilia A. But also it showed us that the drug levels of emicizumab in infants were comparable to previous studies in adult populations, something that we did not see with other molecules in general, especially factor VIII replacement therapies, taking into consideration the higher clearance in general in a younger population. So you can see here that all bleeds actually and treated bleeds, but also like mainly spontaneous bleeds, and joint bleeds were undetectable. And you can see that the range of age that were included in this study went from 9 days to 11 months and 30 days. That can help us like in counseling our families on what treatment to start. As far as after the clinical trials, and there's ongoing registry, there are ongoing registries in different countries that are capturing real world data on and especially the safety of emicizumab prophylaxis. You can see here some of these registries cited, the UK registry, the Canadian registry, the PEDNET in Europe, Canada, and Israel, as well as the Athens 7 in the US. And the high number of patients that are enrolled in these registries with, in summary, no new safety concerns that have been reported so far, especially the thromboembolic events and TMA or anaphylaxis events, there hasn't been any that were reported. In addition to emicizumab that has been approved for so many years, there is there are new generations of mimetics that are being actually studied. MIM-8 is probably closer or more advanced in studies than other of these mimetics. It is a novel factor VIII mimetic. It's also given sub-Q, and it was studied for prophylactic treatment of hemophilia A with and without inhibitors. It's fully human IgG4, and it does have unique binding epitopes, to factor 9 and factor 10. So on this side, in this slide, you can see the reports from the multiple ascending dose cohorts and the phase 2 trial, where after loading dose on day 1 and day 8, There were ascending doses for maintenance, and of note, the maintenance dose was actually divided into by weight. So for lower weight or less than 60 kilograms, there was an assigned maintenance dose, and for higher doses or above 60 kilograms, there was another assigned maintenance dose. And as you can see here, there was a low number of treated bleeds beyond really cohort one, and especially in cohort two through four, where there were no spontaneous bleeds. Cohort four is different from the other cohorts in terms that the maintenance dose was actually given every 4 weeks and not weekly like the other cohorts. In cohort five, there were 10 spontaneous bleeds that were actually reported. However, 8 of these bleeding events occurred in one patient, and 2 other occurred in 2 patients before they reached their steady state. And data from cohorts 3 and 4 support the weekly to monthly dosing of MIM-8. When we compare the potency, if you want to say, like, of this new molecule MIM-8 to emicizumab, you can see that there were two actually parts two results that are actually presented here. First of all, the in vitro data where MIM-8 was 15 times more potent than emicizumab. And that gives the potential for using lower doses. And that is represented in the linear curves with the light blue emicizumab curve, and the dark blue is actually MIM-8 curve. But in addition to that, out of Frontier 1, thrombin generation or thrombin peak were also captured in the different cohorts. And you can see that also like emicizumab thrombin generation potential was comparable to the cohort 2, who were administered one of the lower MIM-8 doses during Frontier 1, keeping in mind, again, that cohort 3 and 4 had higher doses. So MIM-8 increased thrombin generation at much lower plasma concentrations than emicizumab, again, demonstrating its higher potency in vitro and in vivo. In addition to that, the Frontier 1 so far has shown that MIM-8 is safe and well-tolerated, with most of the treatment adverse events being mild or moderate in severity and resolved before the end of the study. There were no trends in the frequency, type, or severity across all cohorts, and there were no anti-MIM-8 antibodies that were detected, and no excessive coagulation reported. Even at higher doses. This is, in this slide, you can see actually the different dosing or the different doses and dosing schedule that can be offered based on desired dosing frequency for and patient's body weight. So you can see, like, for patients that are heavier than 45 kilograms, there is a different dosing, whether the patient goes with weekly maintenance dose, Q2 weeks or monthly. And if they're less than 15 kilogram weight, then there's also a different dose. Also of note that this is a molecule that can be administered by pen. In addition to MIM-8, there is another molecule that is probably at earlier still phases of development, and it's we can call it like EMI 2.0 or the next generation of EMI, because it is engineered and optimized based on emicizumab. It's called so far NXT007, and it was optimized at different levels, increasing the availability or the half-life of the product, but also improving its kinetic profile in terms of optimizing its affinity to the factor 9, and factor 10. Now we're going to talk a little bit about a case of a newborn male diagnosed with severe factor 8 deficiency at birth. His parents would like to know what are the options for treatment and how protected the patient will be. So Dr. Shapiro, what would you recommend for this patient? Do you wait until the age of 12 like we used to do in the past, probably? or do you recommend to start prophylaxis as soon as possible?
We recommend starting prophylaxis as soon as possible. Our clinical experience has shown us that waiting until a later date exposes the child to risk of bleeding, which can be difficult to treat, especially because venous access can be a problem in these young children. The other issue is that parents are often very protective of a child who's untreated. They worry about their activities, everything that happens at home, every bump or fall as they begin to walk and become more mobile. And having emicizumab starting very early in life, and we've started patients very close to birth, gives parents a feeling of increased protection and safety, and actually does provide hemostatic coverage for children at this very early age, so that the risk of experiencing bleeding episodes in that first year is very well decreased.
Yes, I agree definitely with you. There's obviously a benefit of starting prophylaxis earlier and as soon as possible. We were limited before with the IV need to play sports and the IV access, but the emicizumab advantage, and as you said, and as I already mentioned before, even seven data has proven the efficacy and safety of emicizumab in this age group. Therefore, we're definitely highly recommending to start ME as soon as possible for the convenience, safety, and efficacy. Now I'll give you the stage.
Thank you. Thank you for that great presentation and overview of these agents. We're now going to speak a bit more about mild and moderate matters. And I think this is a very important topic, close to my heart, because of what we've seen our patients experience. So again, what we're speaking about are individuals whose levels are moderate, between 1 and 5%. We know that bleeding continues in these patients once it's started, longer than normal. And it happens fairly easily in these individuals, so that some of the activities of daily life, or what we would consider just minor, very minor injuries, you know, stepping off of a curb incorrectly, can precipitate a bleeding episode. Patients with mild hemophilia A have levels above 5% to approximately 40%. We know that individuals whose levels are above 40%, usually if a bleed is initiated, they can often achieve hemostasis as fairly close to a normal individual. But people whose levels are less than 40%, the bleeding does continue longer than normal. It's usually induced by an injury or surgery. But what we have to really think about is, what is the clinical phenotype that our patients experience? So we can't just get stuck on the level a patient has. We have to step back and think about their clinical phenotype. And these vary quite a bit among patients. Some patients can present with bleeding phenotypes that overlap severe disease. It's quite interesting when this happens. We don't know all of the contributing factors that cause this difference in phenotype, but we have well-documented evidence that this occurs. We know that patients who don't bleed very often, either with mild or moderate disease, experience difficulty recognizing the difference between a bleeding event or an injury that's complicated by a bleeding event. So oftentimes they present late, with very complicated bleeding events that require fairly intensive therapy, and can suffer joint disease even with one bleeding event that has been prolonged. Many of these patients tend to ignore their bleeding disorder, and they're unprepared for a bleeding event when it occurs. They may not be well connected with their hemophilia treatment center. They often can't self-infuse because of the infrequency of the need and the lack of technical ability. So their care can be quite complicated. We're going to talk a bit now about what's called the Dynamo study. And actually, we're going to cover about five studies that look at specifically the mild and moderate population and what they've experienced. The Dynamo study is the dynamic interplay between bleeding phenotype and baseline factor level in moderate and mild hemophilia A and B. So factor 9 deficiency was included in this study. This study is males only. There were 304 males included in this study with age ranges between 12 and 55 years and a factor baseline activity that ranged between 2 to 35%. The median baseline activity was 12%. The primary and secondary aims of the study were to describe the bleeding phenotype in non-severe hemophilia A and B and to assess the association between their baseline levels and the joint bleeding rate. On the first bar up above in red, what you see is that 51% of the population had experienced at least one, if not more, joint bleed in the past. And the median age at the first joint bleed was about 10 years of age. On the bottom, you can see a scatter plot of their levels and the joint, the annualized joint bleeding rate. And as you approach approximately 25%, the median ABR decreased from the levels of 2 to 5% to up to greater than 25% from 0.6 to 0.1. And this means that the baseline factor 8 and 9 activity level was inversely associated with the joint bleeding rate. These are the consequences of mild and moderate hemophilia from data from the CDC registry from the United States. And what we see here is the curves on the right with different cohorts of individuals with different ranges of level. On the bottom is the blue from 0 to 0.9%, so the severe patients, which show the highest rate of loss of range of motion as they increase in age. But you can also see in the curves, the three curves above, with levels from 1 to approximately 9%, there is a loss of range of motion as individuals age, probably greater than what we see in the normal population. And this is likely due to the impact of their bleeding disorder in terms of bleeds and range of motion over time. So persons with mild and moderate hemophilia A lose joint range of motion over time compared to their unaffected population. This is a post hoc analysis of what was called the PROPEL study. This study looked at patients with severe hemophilia A and used targeted PK analysis to actually achieve specific trough levels in the population that were treated. In this analysis, the bands from 20% and above showed the best or the most suppression of total bleeding events, spontaneous bleeds, spontaneous joint bleeds, and injury-related bleeds. To achieve these trough levels, the number of infusions required was fairly high. Some patients had to infuse every day, but they did achieve suppression of bleeding episodes when their levels, trough levels, were above 20%. So what is the minimum factor 8 level needed to prevent joint bleeds? And this is another study that speaks to this. This is from Italy, from Milan, a single center study looking at 270 patients. And in this study, they had patients who were greater than or equal to 16 years of age, and they included mild hemophilia A, and they only looked at on-demand treatment. So the population was not confused with individuals who were getting any form of prophylaxis, and none of these patients had inhibitors. And what they found was that the minimum factor VIII level needed to prevent lifelong any joint bleeds and spontaneous joint bleeds was approximately 19% factor VIII activity and 17.7 or 18% for all spontaneous joint bleeds, respectively. That's fairly close to the PROPEL study, but these are mild patients, not severe patients, who may have experienced some joint disease and may have an increased tendency for bleeding even at a higher trough due to the damage in their specific joints. This data results from the HAVEN 6 study, which evaluated the use of emicizumab in mild and moderate hemophilia A without inhibitors. And this was an important study because it looked at providing this factor VIII mimetic that gives you consistent levels over time to the mild and moderate patients specifically. And this was a phase 3 multi-center single-arm study of prophylaxis in patients with mild and moderate hemophilia A without inhibitors. The safety endpoints are fairly usual for the emicizumab study and are listed here. And the efficacy endpoints were the ABRs for treated bleeds, all bleeds, joint, target joint, and spontaneous bleeds, and they used a negative binomial regression model. They had 69 males and 3 females, so women were allowed in this study, and that was nice, with mild and moderate hemophilia A, because that's a population that is usually excluded from these types of studies. One interesting thing here was that the investigator determined that these patients might warrant prophylaxis. So this wasn't a random selection of moderate and mild patients, but a selection of patients that the investigators felt that prophylaxis would be a good therapy for these patients. And the ages ranged from 2 to 71 years and included 51 moderate and 21 mild patients. Patients after loading doses were treated either Q-week, every 2 weeks, or every 4 weeks by the participant's choice as their maintenance dose. And what we found was that the emicizumab effectively reduced the ABRs in this population. The model-based ABRs for treated bleeds was 0.9, and for treated joint bleeds was 0.1, so very low. And this really showed safety and efficacy in the mild and moderate population as well. Of interest, the majority of the treated bleeds, about 79%, were traumatic. So injury bleeds can still occur, and 21% were spontaneous. So emicizumab demonstrated consistent safety and was well tolerated. These are just the specific safety data that was available from this study. It doesn't look really any different than any of the other emicizumab studies, including severe reactions. There was one thrombotic event that was related to thrombosed hemorrhoids and was felt not to be related to the emicizumab in it of itself. So emicizumab effectively reduced the ABRs in mild and moderate patients overall, but here's a subpopulation study looking at the individuals who participated in this study who were greater than or equal to 40 years of age with and without comorbidities. And the reason this data cut was evaluated was because we know our older patients or individuals as they age are at increased risk of other aging events, including atherosclerotic disease, MIs, strokes, et cetera. And we want to make sure that providing this consistent level through emicizumab is safe in this population. There were only a small number of individuals who met this criteria. There were 10 participants with moderate hemophilia A and 6 with mild in this subgroup who were over equal to or over 40 years of age. Prior to study, 6 were being treated with factor VIII prophylaxis and 10 were treated with episodic infusions. 3 participants had HCV, 1 had HIV only, and 2 had combined HCV and HIV co-infection. And that's particularly important when looking at liver disease and liver capacity for hemostatic function in this population. The mean ABR for treated bleeds of these 16 participants was 1.03, and 11 participants had 0 bleeds, and there were no specific safety events that were noted, including the ones that we're concerned about in our aging population. But again, this is a small cut, a smaller population from the study. So real-world experience in this population will also add to this information as time goes on. Data was also collected from the patients themselves about the burden of care and the quality of life. They used a specific tool that was developed called the CATCH score. And from this CATCH score, you can actually look at the treatment burden. And that score in this domain showed a trend to improvement from baseline in both the adolescent and adult populations. The other CATCH domains, which include quite a few domains, were stable throughout the study as compared to baseline, but treatment burden was somewhat improved over time. So this is actually a patient from our center. He's a 38-year-old gentleman. He has moderate factor VIII deficiency. He likes to ignore that he has an underlying bleeding disorder. He has successfully, over many years, avoided coming to the hemophilia treatment center. But at one time, we got called because he reported a severe right thigh bleed. I believe it was related to participation in baseball and some injury he experienced during that activity. It had started about a week earlier. He had, as you might expect, because of his lack of contact and avoidance of medical intervention, no product at home for treatment. And he doesn't know how to self-infuse. He actually has some needle phobia. He went to his local ER. He reported he didn't want to come to the treatment center. He waited for 3 hours before the time he was arrival to the time he was infused. And that doesn't meet national standards either, even though the bleed had gone on for quite a while. He was infused with an unknown correction of a product. It was not possible to figure out how they calculated a correction, and we couldn't get the number of units administered. And he was sent home. He came the next day for another infusion because the pain and the swelling continued. He was given another infusion and he was told, "You're good to go." But we called him because he had called us initially and convinced him finally to come to the treatment center. So by the time he was seen by us, it was 13 days after the initial injury. Our evaluation and physical findings revealed a really large thigh hematoma and a knee hemarthrosis. We placed a heparin lock in him for administration of daily therapy that started at the treatment center and would continue at home through follow-up to get him through actual treatment of this prolonged bleeding episode and then the rehabilitation that was required. So I'd like to open this up again to my colleague to discuss how this highlights importance of specialized care at the treatment center, how you might identify patients who are not severe, who would benefit from prophylaxis, and other issues related to the treatment of these populations.
I mean, you did highlight like a very important thing. These patients really live in denial for so long, and they try to avoid coming to the HCC or to specialized seeking specialized care for so long. We have actually identified mild or moderate patients only when they needed clearance for their surgery. And some of them, yeah, managed like probably for years not to have a bleed. But then, as you said, also like they're carrying on like sometimes like active lifestyle. So there's definitely some damage that is occurring in their joints and on the long run and probably at earlier compared to like you have shown compared to the same age non-hemophilia population. But I mean, I think like increasing awareness, it's easy to capture the patients from a family, but it's like really the patients, the families that have been avoiding us probably by reaching out to the community doctors more and like asking them to refer them early on to the hemophilia center. So we're not rushing a clearance plan before a procedure or treating after the fact and dealing with long-term damage sometimes.
I'll give you some follow-up about what we did also do for this patient. We also talked about his prior bleeding events. We did a full musculoskeletal evaluation. We also did point-of-care musculoskeletal ultrasound and showed him the bleed that existed in his thigh and his knee, which I really think helps these patients with mild and moderate disease understand the need for prolonged therapy, the need for contact with their treatment center, and the need for adequate rehabilitation. We discussed the need for extended coverage for this bleeding episode because he really can't adequately go through physical therapy to retain baseline function without coverage. And we talked about his long-term treatment options, which he's still somewhat resistant to, but we continue to discuss this. I'll now turn it over to Dr. Jean Bain again.
Thank you. In this module, I'll be talking about caring for another challenging population with hemophilia, who are women with hemophilia. And we all are familiar with the challenges in this patient population, starting with the disparities really in the care of these women, where there's need for more self-awareness and advocacy. There's also very limited access to care and treatment plans. And I want to say also like healthcare providers probably were less aggressive in acknowledging the bleeding symptoms of these women and probably dismissing them for the majority, especially like those related to the reproductive tract. And the lack of representation in clinical trials up till recently when we saw more women actually included in phase 3 clinical trials for the different molecules. In this actually slide, you can see like from two publications in 2021, but also like in 2023, so very recent publications, the different bleeding patterns in women with hemophilia. And you can see they're similar to and maybe similar to males with same factor level. So like males with mild to moderate hemophilia, with more specifics probably to the bleeding to in the reproductive tract and heavy menstrual bleeding and postpartum bleeding. And these two studies, 600 females were actually followed, and 45% of them, of the carriers, had baseline levels less than 50%. But you can see that these women, in addition to their mucocutaneous bleeds, also might present with joint bleeding and also have like outcome of this long-term bleeding that presents with iron deficiency anemia or iron deficiency in general. In the next few slides, I'll discuss like the available data that we have on women with hemophilia, with the limitation of this data, hoping definitely for better quality data in the future. I'll start with this results that were shown from the PICNIC Health database, where you can see that the bleeding pattern of females with mild hemophilia was compared to males with mild hemophilia. We know the limitation of the PICNIC Health database in terms of like the selection or the women that are or the patients that are actually studied or enrolled in this database. They're approached by a third party, so not really by their caring or healthcare providers, and therefore there is probably selection bias in who is signing up. But it was a small number in general in this paper. 60% of the males and females did not have reported bleeding events. So there were less bleeding events really to examine or study. But you can see that they're similar somehow to the males with mild hemophilia A with traumatic bleeds in terms of traumatic bleeds and spontaneous bleeds. Surprisingly, there were less procedure-related bleeds in females with hemophilia. Another paper that was published recently and looked at the clinical characteristics, but also the cost and the bleed patterns between female hemophilia carriers and non-hemophilia carriers. Of course, this study has a little bit of has its limitations in terms of it looked at claims, commercial claims and Medicaid claims. So taking into consideration if the claims really reflected all of the or the codes that were actually reported were correct or not. But these claims looked at inpatient services, outpatient services, admissions, prescription drugs, long-term care, and they actually looked at hemophilia A carriers between 0 and 89 years of age, and the control population were random, was a random sample of 10,000 females enrollees without a diagnosis of hemophilia A or other bleeding disorders. And what this study showed was that there was actually across the different claims, whether commercial or Medicaid, you can see that hemophilia A carriers had higher joint bleeds, and their joint health in general was, there were more claims actually related to joint health than in non-hemophilia A carriers. Also, you can see that the mean annualized bleeding rate in both databases was higher in the hemophilia carriers when it was compared to the non-hemophilia A carriers. They also noted that heavy menstrual bleeding was more frequent in the hemophilia A carrier, but surprisingly, the use of hormonal therapy or other drugs to address this bleeding was same between the two groups. And they did also note that there were more pregnancy claims captured in the hemophilia A carriers, which probably can tell us that some of these carriers are not diagnosed till late or till they're pregnant, and therefore there is delay in care administered to this patient population. When they compared the type of bleeds, major and minor, it was also noted that major bleeds and minor bleeds were higher in there was a trend to higher bleeds in the hemophilia A carriers compared to the control group. And when they looked at also whether spontaneous or traumatic bleeds, also they tended to be higher, especially for spontaneous bleeds across the two databases in the hemophilia A carrier compared to the control groups. As far as healthcare utilization and emergency department presentation and patient visits, it was also higher in the hemophilia A carriers. So that is leading to higher total costs in the hemophilia A carrier group when it was compared to the control group. The third paper that I'm going to present quickly here is a paper that is probably older than the two other papers, and it was published in 2014, but it did show the impact of the factor deficiency in female carriers on joint health. And you can see here that the curves of joint health, like joint health usually, I mean, it's across different ages, it gets, or the range of motion gets more limited with time. But when we look at hemophilia carriers with lower levels, the limitation and range of motion is more pronounced at younger age, even in the teenage, which is definitely concerning, and also like highlighting the need for earlier intervention and a more aggressive and optimized care in this patient population. Haven 6 is the trial that looked at or the role of emicizumab and in mild and moderate, but they also included patients, female patients in this study. And here were actually the three women that were represented in this study. Patient one had moderate levels, but patient two and three had actually mild levels, 7% and 15%. You can see that they tried to capture actually the menstrual bleeding questionnaire, and they saw that there was improvement of this score and the bleeding menstrual bleeding pattern after prophylaxis. Actually, the PBAC score per month, as you can see here, has improved after initiation of prophylaxis. But also, they tried to capture the treatment burden, which was also noted to be improved with emicizumab prophylaxis. And two of the things that these patients noted in general were the convenience or the route of administration, which is the subcutaneous compared to the IV infusion that they were doing before. The frequency also of like once weekly was also a plus to the emicizumab prophylaxis in this patient population. More data about the role of emicizumab prophylaxis in females is captured in Athens 7. Also, like two of the participants that that haven't so far enrolled, like had no bleeds, whether treated or untreated. And one participant had one treated bleed associated with a dental procedure and one untreated associated with menses, and did report some episodes of heavy menstrual bleeding that had to be addressed with administration of tranexamic acid. But no adverse events were so far reported during the exposure to emicizumab, and that was over a total of 5+ years. So that brings us to the case discussion of a 19-year-old lady with a mild hemophilia A that is seeking medical attention for her menorrhagia. Obviously, she has menorrhagia, as this did lead to severe iron deficiency. Her menstrual period lasts like on average 9 to 10 days. She had tried DDAVP in the past, but it did not control her bleeding pretty well. And she was not able to tolerate tranexamic acid due to some GI symptoms. And hormonal therapies was not an option for treatment, as we know some, this is the case with a lot of our patients, for cultural, religious, and also for patients that are planning to get pregnant, where they have to be taken off a hormonal therapy. But of course, with offering them good measures to treat their bleeds, and therefore, there we need to counsel these patients definitely more, but we need to emphasize the role of multidisciplinary care team by including and communicating with their woman health provider. But in addition, at this point with this patient, I think like it's very important to discuss treatment options that are available now and to prevent her bleeds in terms of prophylaxis, whether it's continuous prophylaxis with emicizumab or also weekly emicizumab, or just what we call by intermittent prophylaxis, which is the administration of factor VIII replacement therapy timed at the beginning of the menstrual period to control the blood flow. Do you agree with that, Dr. Shapiro?
Yes, I think those are very good options to discuss with this patient.
And with this slide, again, we do we want to again and again more emphasize about the role of a multidisciplinary approach to care for these challenging population, hemophilia A carriers, but also the patients with mild and moderate hemophilia A, starting with their hematologist, specialized nurse, dentist that is familiar with their bleeding disorder, a social worker, a pharmacist, and also a genetic counselor, so that we don't have to deal with the inheritance and all of that like at last minute in our especially pregnant ladies.
So in summary, we'd like to just review some take-home points. As we target higher levels for our patients with severe disease, we have to think about who we're leaving behind, specifically moderate and some mild patients who are at risk, higher risk of bleeding and associated morbidity. And we've shown you data that supports this. We need identification of important needs beyond acute bleeding in persons with non-severe hemophilia. We should look at those. What are the patient's individual goals in life? What kinds of activities do they want to participate in that they can't because of their specific factor level? Women with factor levels less than 40% are classified as having mild hemophilia. So we need to be careful with our terminology. They're not just carriers. They are women with mild hemophilia. Women have specific bleeding issues, as Dr. Jean Bain has very clearly outlined, related to the reproductive tract, and tracking of successful treatment can be challenging in these circumstances, but needs to be attended to. Women who carry hemophilia must have their factor levels checked and appropriate care plans made by the multidisciplinary team, as again, Dr. Jean Bain has noted. They benefit from all the services of a multidisciplinary team at a hemophilia treatment center. So we need to include them in our care model. And I thank you very much for your attention and participation in this webinar.
This activity is certified by PVI, Peerview Institute for Medical Education. Remember to download the slides and practice aids. Thank you for listening. Download materials and complete the post-test for instant credit at peerview.com/GJM860. This activity is supported by educational grants from Genentech, a member of the Roche Group, and Novo Nordisk Incorporated.